It's in the rhetoric of the 2016 campaign. It's in the tragedy of the European migrant crisis. The borders of the modern nation state are being everywhere tested. Nationhood, which came into being at the end of the Napoleonic era in the 1800s and grew to become the essential symbol of political order at the end of the 20th century. Nations and flags added up to human civilization at the dawn of the 21st century, but it didn't add up. You can hear the defensiveness of the nation state in Donald Trump's plans to build walls. You can hear the fear of the nation state in the political rhetoric of right-wing nationalists in Austria, Germany, and France. But perhaps the most successful challenge to the nation state is the quietest and the oldest. Nick McDonald spent years with nomadic groups around the world and studies their histories and political practice. He's the author of the new book, The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World. Nick says nomads are finally demanding that their way of life be recognized politically by the imperfect nation states that have tried to pen them in for centuries.
Nomadism has been a challenge to the nation state since there have been nation states. In fact, if you look at the historical record, you will see in some parts of the world that though there were hunter-gatherers to begin with, there was agriculture after that, and then after that, there was larger scale nomadism, because oftentimes nomads were folks who did not want to have to farm and be taxed and conscripted the way that whoever was running the valley wanted them to be. For a great number of people, it is a form of life, a political expression that is as vibrant and as important as any other.
At a moment when the United Nations, given the refugee crisis in Syria and in Europe, is trying to figure out ways of giving people an identity that's independent from national state passports, what do you think nomadism says about identity and being in a nation state in the 21st century?
I think if you look at nomadism over the grand durée, what it says is that it doesn't have to be this way. And that's the thing that it always was for me. When I was in graduate school, I read a textbook that they assigned to us. And it said, nomads have played no major role in world history for 500 years. And I thought, that doesn't square with what I've seen as a reporter. And as I looked into the various nomads around the world, I realized these borders don't have to be this way. And if you look at the migration crisis now, who is from where and why they should be from where is something that as a whole world we're reexamining. And the practice of nomadism has been about that from day one.
And in fact, a lot of the problems in the world relate to obstacles in the way of nomadic tendencies. I mean, I think Saudi Arabia, for instance, there's no reason why the House of Saud would settle down except for the fact that they had all the oil.
Saudi Arabia is a place I never did any research. But, you know, the decision to settle to accrue wealth is not totally exclusive from nomadism. I mean, there were plenty of rich nomads, but certainly it led us down a particular path. I mean, agriculture is one way to go. Nomadism is another. In this country, for example, we wrote all kinds of laws about why agriculture is the basis of our republic. And if you own land, then you get to vote. Historically, people are always trying to sedentarize nomads. Governments, as a rule, don't like it when you move around, because when you move around, it's hard to count you, it's hard to tax you, it's hard to conscript you into the army. And so in nearly every government in the history of the world, they have seen groups of nomadic people and they have said, you must stop moving. And the argument that I make in this book is that often that's not the best thing for the government. And certainly it's not best for the environmental, you know, future of certain parts of the world.
Among the nomads you've studied and done research on, who's having the best time?
Ooh. Oh, boy. In the Gobi Desert, I had the great pleasure of spending a little time with a whole bunch of nomadic families. And one old lady explained to me, her name was Jamyan Seren. And Jamyan Seren was telling me about her grandchildren and how they would come and hang with her sometimes, but other times the next generation spent most of its time in Ulaanbaatar. And she said, you know, being a nomad is the best thing in the world. It's the best way to live when the weather is good. But I think that it's not going to be this way for my children and my children's children. I hope it is. But a lot of them want to live in the city. But it is the best way to live when the weather's good. No one wants to stand in the snow looking for sheep when it's windy, etc. But those afternoons with her and that family out there, you can see, without romanticizing it, because it's not rich, it's not, you know, it's not always great, literacy is not great. These are people who are smart, satisfied, and know what else is out there.
Any attraction for you?
It's hard to imagine growing up in New York City that you would want to spend more than a month moving across the tundra with reindeer. And yet, you get up there, and when it's not so cold, suddenly it seems like this isn't such a bad way to live. And that's the thing about nomadism. I mean, it looks as far away from New York City as you can get. But once you start doing it, it doesn't actually seem to be so different than some of the things you've seen before.
How much variation is the ways in which family rules and family needs sorted out in a nomadic context?
The Kuchi of Afghanistan have a very rough deal. They are often poor, they are often illiterate, and they move through byways that are often at war with between the Taliban and the United States, different groups out there on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border. But the women in the Kuchi families often are treated and assume a much more serious position than the men. And I think this is a true thing of nomadism, that the family unit and the small unit of organization tends to be more egalitarian.
Finally, can you describe the most arresting visual contrast between a nomad who's practicing behaviors and traditions that are hundreds, perhaps thousands of years old, and some technology that is, you know, of the moment?
Well, there are many of those, and they are fantastic. The one that stayed with me, and I unfortunately did not see this myself, but it was reported to me, and there were pictures of it. There is a gentleman named Mukbayar Setsergi, depending on your point of view, an eco-terrorist or a radical or a revolutionary. He's a Mongolian fellow, and he believes that Mongolia, a country where 30% of the population still fully is nomadic, at least part of the year, should stay that way. And there's a great deal of copper in Mongolia, and the economy is changing very rapidly. Some people say it'll be like the Brunei of Central Asia. But Mukbayar doesn't want it to go that way. He thinks that people should remain nomadic. And to make his point, Mukbayar and his attorney rode on horseback past the statue of Lenin, past the Louis Vuitton shop, and into Sukhbatar Square in the center of Ulaanbaatar, where Mukbayar then fired his bow and arrow into the windows of the Mongolian parliament before being taken to prison. And this, I thought, was an extremely shrewd piece of political theater, which he was aware of and stayed certainly with the Mongolian population and with me.
And pictures of it which are likely shared on nomadic-owned iPhones all around the world.
Very true, yeah.
Nick, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Nick McDonald is the author of The Civilization of Perpetual Movement, Nomads in the Modern World.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.